Joe Sr. was still banging his fist against the object. Joe tugged on his shirt. "Look," Joe told his dad. "Look up there." At that moment, a thin, metallic great staircase extruded from the side of the craft. The staircase was lightly constructed and very narrow. Joe Sr. picked Joe up, turned sideways, and scaled the stairs, which flexed under their weight. At the top was an open doorway, with a strange featureless silver door, apparently hinged on the left side. Joe immediately noticed a figure, an odd-looking man sitting in what appeared to be an upholstered chair. He had big black eyes like an ant, Joe says, a big round head, spindly arms, a spindly body. He was wearing a green plaid shirt, blue jeans and boots. But when he stood up, he really looked like a bug, because he was tall. He welcomed us inside. "Dad," Joe shouted out. "That man looks like a big bug." Joe's father immediately chided him. "Don't say that. That's rude. It's not nice." Joe was surprised. Couldn't his father see what this man looked like? The bugman was obviously not normal, and yet Joe's father didn't seem to notice. They were in a large round room, fully lit with bright white light coming from no discernible source. The floors curved up into the walls and the ceiling. A small shelf or counter encircled about a third of the room, made of the same material as the wall, with no visible seams or designs. It was as if the entire structure was molded out of one single piece. "Wow," Joe Sr. said, looking around the room. "This is interesting. Where do you get your power from?" The bugman opened some low cabinets and showed Joe's father the contents. Eager to see, Joe tried to squeeze between them. His father became angry and pushed him back. "You don't know what you're looking at here, boy. You don't understand this." Joe staggered back. "There's something to eat and drink on the table over there," the bugman said. Joe looked where the bugman pointed and saw a pedestal with a small round surface. There was a plate and a cup. The plate held a small number of little black disc-shaped objects, which Joe assumed were chocolate cookies. "I got excited," Joe says. "I ran over there, picked one up and bit into it. And it was bitter, terribly bitter." The cookie tasted so bad that Joe immediately put the rest of it back on the plate and looked around for some place to spit the nasty stuff out of his mouth. "There was no trash can anywhere," Joe says, "so I just swallowed it out of politeness." Hoping to wash the bitter taste from his mouth, he looked at the strange cup. It was a tall tumbler, very heavy and with thick sides. It looked like it was made of stone or pottery. Inside, it held a greenish-yellow liquid with a viscosity or pancake batter. Joe had to use both hands to grip it and tilt it into his mouth. "As soon as it hit my mouth," he said, "I just blacked out. The next thing I knew, when I came to, conscious and awake, I was lying on a cold, metal table. I couldn't move at all. I couldn't move anything but my eyes." When he had entered the craft, Joe was dressed in blue shorts, a yellow and brown striped shirt and shoes. He was now naked except for his shirt. He lay on his left side in a fetal position. In front of him was his father, who sat on a bench. "He's just sitting there," Joe says, "and he's got his hands on top of his legs. His mouth open, his eyes wide open and unblinking. And I'm looking at him and pleading with him. I can't cry. I can't shout. I can't wave to him. I can't do anything but look at him with my eyes and think with my mind, 'Dad, help me, Dad. Please.'" But he looked like he was asleep with his eyes open. A bright light shone down on the table above Joe. Walking around the table and into his field of view was a figure wearing a white smock, much like a doctor's uniform. He saw the being's arm and hand, which had three long, smooth fingers. The fingers were kind of wrapped around what looked like a long stainless steel knife, with a handle made of the same metal. For the first time since the onboard encounter began, Joe felt real distress. "They're monsters," he thought. "They're going to eat us." What happened next was perhaps the most unpleasant part of the experience so far. "I felt something very cold and hard, like a rod or a cold pipe, just go up inside of me. And then I blanked out again." An undetermined time later, Joe heard his name being called. "Jojo," A woman's voice said softly. Jojo. When I came to again, Jo says, there was a tall gray. It was like she was there to be reassuring. She was kind of soft-natured. And she had these big, large almond eyes, real liquidy, a very slight mouth, just an indentation, but it had a slight smile, no nose, no ear holes I could see, no hair. Most bizarre was that the gray had a sparkly aura of glittering, glowing particles swirling in a vortex around her head. She was very gentle and comforting as she roused Jo to full wakefulness. Although he was awake, Jo says that his consciousness now felt slightly altered. Prior to this, reality seemed normal. Now, however, there was a strange, hazy altered reality that seemed to pervade his senses. The gray held Joe's right hand and telepathically asked him, "Would you like to see the ship?" "Ah, yeah," Jo said. As the gray helped him down, Jo saw that the table was not symmetrical, but instead appeared to be curved, with a minor dip in the center. The bright light above him was now extinguished, and the room seemed enveloped in a hazy twilight. A low-lying fog or mist swirled round the base of the floor. Jo detected an acrid odor like sulfur. The female gray led Jo to a shallow ramp which spiraled round a central column and led up to a higher level. They climbed the ramp, leaving the foggy room behind them. While Jo had to walk, the female gray glided upward, without moving her legs. Once on the upper deck, Jo saw that the floor, which had been white, now appeared like smoothly polished black obsidian glass. The room itself was so large that he couldn't see any walls. Instead, his attention was drawn to three chairs much like you'd see in a dental office, with a large pedestal-like base, a footrest, thick armrests, and other equipment. The chairs were all in a row, and sitting in each one was a member of his family, his father, his mother and his sister. They were reclined backward and unmoving. A cone of light shone down from above over each of them. Otherwise, the room was dark. A blur of activity swirled like a whirlwind around each of them. The movement was so rapid, Jo was unable to register what he was seeing. When he saw his sister sitting there, mouth and eyes wide open, with all that weird activity around her, he became frightened and upset. "Stop! Stop!" Jo screamed and pleaded, pointing at his sister. "You're hurting my sister. You've got to stop." The gray leaned down, placed her forehead against Joe's forehead, and told him telepathically, "It's just to check up. It's okay, it's just to check up." She repeated it several times until Jo finally calmed down. Jo could still see no walls, but it was clear that the spaceship house was far larger on the inside than it had appeared on the outside. Still holding his hand, the gray asked Jo, "Would you like to see the stars?" Jo said yes. "So, she took me to an upper level where I could definitely see we were under some type of dome. I'm not sure how big, but it was pretty expansive. And we could see the stars through the dome." The gray peered upward at the stars with rapt wonder and fascination. She seemed more impressed by the view than Jo was. Thinking there was something else up there to see, Jo turned his attention back to the view, but it was just a field of stars. "There's so many of them," he told her. At this point, Jo experienced a strange memory lapse. It was as if a slice of time was gone from his life. The next thing he remembers is sitting in the back seat of the car, behind his dad. "It was like you turned on the TV in the middle of the action," Jo explains. "All of a sudden, it's nighttime and me and my family are back in the car again. And it's like the car hit the ground with a thud. The car must have been going 70-80 miles per hour. My mom is hysterical. My dad is screaming. He's near hysteria." "What happened?" Joe's mother screamed. "What happened?" She was crying, as was Joe's sister, who was crouched down with her head practically under the seat. Jo tried to sit up. "Get down in the seat." His dad screamed. "Get down. What happened?" Joe's mother wailed. "Them damn people are weird," Joe's father said. Says Jo, "I tried to get up out of the seat and off the floor there. I wanted to look. I looked out of the rear window. I saw a bright light and two figures in front of the light, two silhouettes, like paper dolls. The air was really heavy. I remember a smell in the air." My dad was upset. He was damn angry. My mother was hysterical. Joe's mother reached around and smacked him alongside the head for not ducking when her father said to duck. Joe's father drove angrily. "What happened?" Joe's mother asked again. "What happened, Joe?"
"I don't know. But I'm gonna kill them," Joe Sr. shouted. Joe had never seen his father cry before, but now the tears flowed freely.
"Those no good son of garbages. Those motherfuckers." A stream of swearing followed. "I'm gonna kill them," he kept repeating. "I'm gonna kill them." They raced down the road, just putting space between themselves and the incident. They drove for several minutes.
"Where's the refinery?" Joe's mother suddenly asked.
"We should be able to see it." There was a large and highly visible oil refinery in Catlettsburg, Kentucky. The smokestacks were visible for miles around, and yet, there was still no sign of it. Looking around them, they found themselves in an unfamiliar area.
"I think we got lost," Joe's father said.
He pulled a U-turn, and eager to return home, they raced back in the other direction. Without warning, their speed was halted by a thick wall of fog stretching across the width of the road. "It was a big wall of fog," Joe says, "like a thick wall. And then that smell came back, that sulfur smell. And we had to slow down." The fog reduced their speed to a slow crawl. After several minutes, they saw a bright red strobing light. "As we came through that embankment of fog, there was a big red fire engine parked at an angle, blocking almost all the road. And it looked just like the toy fire engine I had at home, with a ladder on it. The headlights were on. There was one single solitary fireman standing in front of the fire truck, holding a hose, but there was barely a trickle. And he had a big smile on his face, and he was just waving at us. He was wearing a yellow fireman's slicker with a big hat, and he looked just like the fireman I had seen on the wall at school. They had to nearly pull onto the shoulder to move past the truck. Now out of the fog, they immediately began to see the signposts leading back home. Joe's father continued to seethe with anger. Joe's sister sobbed, while his mother kept asking, "What happened?"
"There was just this uneasy quiet as we got home. We pulled into the driveway. We got out of the car. My mom's still crying and hysterical. My dad has calmed down, but he's not talking. He's carrying my sister who was just sobbing and wailing. And I'm walking alongside them. I'm like, why are they so upset? Why is everyone so hysterical?
What happened, Joe?"
"I don't know," Joe Sr. repeated. "I don't know."
Joe was confused. He knew exactly what happened. "We were on a spaceship," he announced loudly. "Don't you remember?" Joe's parents looked at him with incredulous shock. They stumbled back inside. Joe's mother looked at the clock. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. The blackberry picking trip, which should have taken an hour or two, had taken about 10 hours or more.
"I'll never forget that night," Joe says. "We all fell asleep in a big pile in the middle of the living room floor. My dad was clutching me so tightly that I had to peel his fingers back to get up and go to the bathroom in the morning. We were all laying in a pile in the middle of the floor." Following the encounter, each of them reacted in different ways. Joe's sister completely denied the event happened, and refused to discuss it. Joe's mother remembered only seeing the object alongside the road. Joe's father never talked about it. Joe, however, was deeply impacted. His mother and sister apparently didn't remember much, and if his father remembered, he wasn't saying. But Joe remembered everything. He immediately began drawing the craft over and over, trying to get the details correct. His father caught him and angrily took the pictures, crumpled them up and threw them in the trash. Joe continued to create more pictures, which he hid underneath his bed. His father found them and destroyed them too. Joe was a little chatterbox, and he talked to everyone he met about being taken on board a spaceship. He had just started kindergarten and was telling everybody he met. He kept drawing pictures of the craft, and also drew images of the big-headed bugman. Again, his father found the pictures and threw them away. Joe still kept talking. A month or two after the encounter, two of Joe's young cousins visited, and all three of them were playing in Joe's bedroom. "Me and my dad went on a spaceship together," Joe told them. "We were on a spaceship. Now, they said. You're lying, says Joe. Just then my dad had walked in from work, and he walked past my bedroom. And one of them said, Mr. G, did you all go on a spaceship? And he didn't say a word, but he nodded his head, yes, and then just walked on by. That's the only time he ever acknowledged it. I felt full of pride right there and then. I was like, aha, see. And my cousins were like, wow. A few weeks later, something happened which would make Joe bury the experience in his mind. It was after school. A man drove up in a sedan and came to the front door. He wore a dark brown suit and mirrored sunglasses. Joe's father and the man talked privately for several minutes, and then the man departed. I'll never forget it, Joe says. When the man left, my dad came in and picked me up off the floor, with both hands on my shoulders, holding me to the wall, throttling me and shaking me. You gotta stop talking about this stuff, his father said angrily, nearly at the point of tears. What? Joe asked. About the spaceship? Yes. Stop talking about it. They're going to lock us up in the nut house. But you were there, Dad, Joe said, also crying. You were there. I know, but you've got to stop talking about this, or they're going to take you kids away and lock you up in the nut house. Joe was devastated. He was telling the truth. He really had been on a spaceship. It didn't seem fair that he couldn't talk about it. But the visit from the stranger was enough to make Joe stop talking about the bugman and the spaceship house. In fact, he did his best to not even think about it, to just forget it. It was pretty traumatizing, Joe explains. Basically, you shut up. After my dad said, you've got to quit talking about this, I actively buried it. Because it made me so sad. I was filled with depression. I can't talk about something that was real. Joe effectively locked the experience up in his mind. Still, various memories and images about what happened constantly intruded into his awareness. 4 years later, at age 8, Joe, now in third grade, woke up to hear his name being called. Jojo, a male voice said softly. Jojo. Joe sat up in bed. His sister lay asleep in her bed on the other side of the room. He heard the name again, echoing inside his head. Still, he looked around for the source. Who was calling him? He tried to wake up his sister, but she wouldn't wake up. I looked outside the window, Joe says. I could see across the street by the railroad tracks, and saw a man on top of a dark saucer. He had his left hand on his hip, and he was waving at me with his right hand. That's when I realized the voice was coming from him. Do you want to go for a ride? The man asked telepathically. Thrilled with delight, Joe said yes. His bedroom was on the second story. They had a very creaky wooden staircase. I had to scoot down the steps on my bottom so I wouldn't make any noise, Joe says. He undid the deadbolt on the front door, and wearing nothing but his pajamas and a pair of socks, he crept across the street up to the flying saucer. It was on stilts, Joe says. It reminded me of the first one, but it was all black and it didn't have a rim on it. It had a ladder I had to climb up. Joe scrambled up the ladder. The man now stood in a doorway and invited Joe inside the craft. The man appeared human. He wore a one-piece jumpsuit that covered his entire body from head to toe, much like a scuba suit, except with an earpiece and antenna alongside his head. A visor covered his eyes. The only opening was a small oval around the mouth. Joe, who is of African American ancestry, noticed that the man's skin was white, like a Caucasian man. There was no visible mustache or facial hair. The man smiled and led Joe to a large chair near the center of the room. The man sat in the chair, scooted back and placed Joe between his legs. Joe was amazed to see the walls fade away and become completely transparent. It was like you were sitting in Wonder Woman's jet, he said. Everything was just transparent. Other than the chair and the controls, the craft was invisible. There were two levers hand-sized, like joysticks, side by side in front of him. One lever, the man said, controlled acceleration. The other controlled the steering. He placed Joe's hands on the lever and instructed him how to fly the craft. You want to see a bird's eye view of your house? The man asked. maneuvering the levers. He pulled the craft over Joe's house. Joe peered down, amazed to see how high they were. "You want to see a bird's eye view of your school?"
"Sure," Joe replied.
The man continued to use the term bird's eye view, leading Joe farther and farther upward, over his city, and then over Earth. The planet hung there in blue splendor, one of many images from this encounter that Joe would never forget.
"Do you want to see Saturn?"
Distracted by the view, he struggled to think.
"What's Saturn?" he asked.
The man was smiling through most of the experience, clearly enjoying Joe's enthusiasm.
"The planet with the rings."
"Yes," Joe replied. He was thrilled to see the stars race by. Occasionally, there was another planet. Suddenly, there was Saturn. Joe was amazed. This was not a dream. It was really happening. Staring at Saturn, Joe remembered seeing the planet in their encyclopedias at home. At some point, they turned round. "I don't remember much conversation on the way back, other than it seemed like he was having a good time watching me have a good time, like you're watching a kid play with a toy." He had a smile. They returned home and hovered over Earth. "At one point," Joe says, "he let me power the craft." Joe took the controls and accidentally drove the craft right into the ground. "I could see the rocks," he said. "We were passing through the rocks, and there were all these sparks flying, dirt, everything." The man laughed good-naturedly, took the controls back and guided the craft back toward Joe's home.
"Don't talk about this," the man warned him, talking out loud.
"Why can't I?" Joe said, immediately upset.
"It's not a lie."
"If it's not a lie, why can't I talk about it?"
"No, you can't tell kids about this, and I know you want to.
Don't talk about this because they'll tease you, just like they tease you about being fat. You know how they make fun of you because you're heavy and it makes you feel bad?"
"Yeah.
They'll tease you about this in the same way."
"Okay," Joe said, though he would later disobey this instruction.
"Study science, astronomy and math," the man said, placing great importance upon it. Joe promised he would. Next thing he knew, he was back in his bed. The following day Joe couldn't resist telling his best friend. "I felt like if I could just tell one person, I had to tell him. He didn't believe me." But Joe came away from the experience convinced it was real. "For days I had this phantom feeling in my hands of touching the joystick and the lever. I had this phantom feeling in my hands for days and days and days." Life went on. He went to school, and immediately moved up into the gifted class where he remained for 2 years. Remembering the man's instructions, he studied hard and felt crushing guilt when he struggled to excel at mathematics. Completing school, Joe went to college, studying for a degree in art. UFOs were the farthest thing from his mind. Then, at 6:45 a.m., on January 27, 1997, at age 22, Joe's life changed forever. It was an icy cold morning, and crystal clear. Dawn was just beginning to break on the eastern horizon, but most of the sky was still black and full of stars. It was a beautiful sight, and as Joe looked toward the strip of blue sky on the horizon, he noticed something moving. "This thing caught my attention," Joe says. "It was a huge green sphere, absolutely huge. It looked like a big green snowball with a white center. It started out on the horizon and kind of followed an arc across the sky. At one point, it was almost directly above me. Then it passed over toward Ohio, to the darker part of the sky, and it just kept getting smaller, disappearing. I kept telling myself, that can't be what I think it is. That can't be." And I had the most sickening repulsive feeling in my stomach. I wanted to go somewhere and hide. I kept shaking my head and saying, "No, no, no. They don't exist. Those things just don't exist." The sighting impressed him deeply. At the time he was a college student, earning a degree in fine art. Other than the strange cylindrical object 17 years earlier, he had never seen anything like this. "It took me by surprise," Joe says. "It shocked me. I was full of awe, but in a way, I had this sickening feeling in my stomach." For some reason, the sighting left him shaken. He didn't feel like it was after him, and it was high in the sky.
But if so, that meant it was massive. And there was no other explanation than UFO. Was he the only one who saw it? If so, why him? He couldn't stop thinking about it. That day he had a dentist appointment. He needed to tell someone, and he had been going to this dentist for years. His dentist shocked him by revealing his own encounters. 11 years earlier, while driving with his wife, they saw a fishbowl-shaped object covered with blue lights. It appeared to come from the river, move over the Steelwell's steel factory and then over Marshall University at treetop level. They followed it along the road to Huntington Hospital, and watched it ascend into the sky and disappear into the distance. Joe was impressed. The dentist had seen the UFO first appear where Joe had seen the green ball, and then had followed it all the way over to where Joe had seen the soda can-shaped object when he was only 4 years old. Still, Joe's most recent sighting lingered in his mind. It was strange because he normally didn't scare easily. He excelled at sports. He would later work as a bouncer and had to kick some big guys out at the bar. When you see something like that, you start to question your eyes. You start to question all your senses, your faculties. Joe found himself staring at the night sky, taking early morning walks with his dog, hoping to see it again. He couldn't get it out of his mind. Finally, he went to the psychology clinic at the university and talked to a therapist. The female therapist interviewed him. After hearing his story, and asking a few more questions, she told him that he was suffering from depression, which had caused him to see lights. She prescribed an antidepressant. Joe left the office, angry and disappointed. It wasn't long before he realized he was actually lucky. He later shared his story with others, who vehemently told him that UFOs were demonic and that he mustn't associate himself with them. Joe wasn't religious, but he learned that people sometimes reacted strongly to the subject. 2 years later, on April 7, 1999, he had another sighting. He worked late as a bill collector, so when he got home, he went outside to walk his dog. It was just before midnight. My dog was doing her business right on the edge of the fence. I looked away out of respect for my dog. And this thing appeared directly in front of me. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life. It was like a piece of a crystal chandelier, like two pyramids stuck together, like a diamond with facets. No pun intended, it was like a diamond in the sky. It was like it was made out of glass. And it had a strobing light inside of it, white hot, like a welder's arc. It was strobing so fast, it kind of distorts your perception. The object appeared to be a few thousand feet high, hovering to the southeast, right outside of town. It wasn't too far away, Joe says. I could see the edges of it very clearly. It had blue and green flames racing all around the outline of it. The object itself was white crystalline. It was rotating like a child's top, just hovering in one place. The moment he saw it, a powerful rush of good feeling swept through him. I see you, he thought. Who are you, and what are you doing here? The next thing I know, Joe says, it was like somebody hit me on the back of the head with a sledgehammer. No. Not now. I looked at the thing, and it sent a column of white light, like a fluorescent tube, straight to there, ground. It looked solid, and then it just blinked out. The column of light disappeared too. Joe scanned the skies, but saw no sign of the object. He continued his walk, still looking for the UFO. He was also still overwhelmed by the feeling of goodness. I'll tell you, Joe says. I never felt so good in my life. I've loved a few women, and they've loved me. But I've never felt such strong emotions as I did that night. It was like I saw a long-lost relative, or a dear, dear long-time friend. I was blissed out for 3 days. I just had this overwhelming peaceful, beautiful feeling in my heart. I could just feel my heart spilling over. It was lovely. I felt like I needed to go somewhere and pray. Transformed by his sighting, Joe started attending church with his dad. He became more interested in God and spirituality. By this time, he was keeping a diary and recording his various UFO encounters. Ultimately,
The sighting sparked Joe's interest in UFOs and he began to educate himself about the UFO subject and also examine his own UFO history. He had just experienced two remarkable UFO encounters in a row.